You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Raymond Sokolov has been a part of the food world for quite a while. He was named food editor of the New York Times in 1971, and the years since, he has been a witness to the good, the bad, and the ugly. Once a waiter brought him an omelet with a cockroach in it. He's written several cookbooks and essays and was one of the founding editors of the Wall Street Journal's Leisure and Arts page. His latest book is called Steal the Menu, a memoir of 40 years in food. It's published by Knopf. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hello.
Hi, Mr. Lopate. Thank you.
You say that you discovered the gastronomic you when you were traveling across Europe in the summer of 1960. Did you have to go to Europe to find it?
Well, I started out in Detroit where the choices were not so obviously interesting, and I was a student where ice cream was the highlight of the meal. So, I would say that I hadn't been primarily interested in food until suddenly I found myself living in France for 13 weeks.
So is French food where you begin? Is that the standard by which you've judged everything else?
Well, it was certainly where I began, and I think for European Western food, it certainly is the basic thing.
What sorts of foods do you discover?
How do you mean? In that year?
Yeah.
I was living for less than a dollar a day in Paris, which you could do then without acquiring, you know, terrible diseases. And down the block was a little bistro called Julien et Petit, and they... That was where I ate the first artichoke of my life, for example, just to show you how basic my education had to be.
Well, there were artichokes in Detroit at the time.
There were, and my mother served them, but I didn't eat them. And I don't think she was aware, actually, that they had a bottom, you know, that was the best part.
Now, you began your career at Newsweek in Paris. Were you writing about food?
Once I did, because my boss had to do something political at the last minute, and he sent me to the furthest east you could go in Alsace on the German border, and I was in a two-star restaurant that got its third star the day I was there. It still has a third star, L'Auberge de Lille in Ilhäusern.
Now, three stars, Michelin, is the top.
It is.
At the New York Times, it's four stars. So people are sometimes confused.
Right. But the Michelin third star means worth a special trip, vaut le voyage.
André Saltner, who had Lutèce, was a chef at Lutèce, later the owner, told the story of coming to New York and not speaking much English. And your predecessor, Craig Claiborne, who was reviewing restaurants at the time, gave him one star. Since he came from Europe, he thought that would be perfectly fine. One Michelin star is great. The next week, Craig gave Chock Full of Nuts two stars, and that's when André understood why everybody was so sad for him. You came back to New York in 67. So
that's right.
By then, you were committed to haute cuisine.
I was really committed to the kind of food life that I had seen in France, and that included haute cuisine, but a whole range of wonderful things.
Well, how did New York compare at the time? Because New York is considered right now one of the great food cities of the world.
Which it is, but I would say at that time it compared dismally. There was a great deal of truly demoralizing French food in the theater district, and the very best places it was very odd because they were shrines of snobbery and also imitation of one restaurant, Le Pavillon, that started out as the French Pavilion at the World's Fair of 1939, and its owner, Henri Soulet, had figured out, because he didn't want to go back to France and live there under the German occupation, so they stayed here, created this restaurant, and it was obviously a whole lot better than anything else we'd ever had, but it calcified, and it wasn't really an accurate representation of what that kind of restaurant would have felt like in France.
Mm-hmm.
Seating mattered more than menu.
Then you wound up replacing Craig Claiborne as the food critic or the food editor?
Yes, food. People who know the current format of food in the New York Times, where there's an entire section with many people working at it, should be reminded that when Claiborne decided he was going to become independent and left the Times, and they found me as a kind of unheard-of person and hired me to do his job, I was writing 3 and 4 times a week, and there was really no one else. We didn't even have a food reporter. I was the restaurant critic. I did food features on Thursday. Big splashy recipe feature in the magazine on Sunday, and they wanted more.
How prepared were you for that? You make it sound like you were far from a food professional when you began.
Compared to, say, Claiborne, who had a degree from a hotel school in Switzerland and had been teaching cooking and so on, I was completely from hunger, you might say. But what I knew I had been in France on an expense account for a major news magazine, and I had been in a lot of places, and I cooked at home. I mean, but I had no professional qualifications to speak of.
So you really had to learn how to be a food critic on the job. And a lot of that involves the way you use the language, doesn't it?
Well, that was certainly my approach. I mean, I think there are many ways of being a food critic, and one of them is to decide that you are going to compare each dish with some platonic recipe you have in your head and tell the reader what went wrong in the kitchen. Now, I began to be able to do that after a while, but I started out as a kind of regular diner with a lot of experience and a writer. And I combined those skills and produced reviews.
But you were learning on the job. Did you look at the early reviews and think, I've come a long way by the time you left?
Looking back on them recently for my new book, I would say that I gained confidence and that I think the writing was fine from the beginning, but it got easier for me to feel that I knew what I was saying.
When you took on a famous restaurant like Le Grenouille, were you afraid at all because it was just so popular?
I should have been. It was one of the charmed 4 or 5 places that people thought of as representing the great food life in New York, and it really wasn't. It had an absurd menu at the time that didn't represent anything in France. I mean, it had Clams Casino on the menu, and it had beautiful flowers, it had beautiful people, and it had, if you were one of them, you were very nicely served. Actually, I was perfectly well treated there, but my French experience made me confident that this was not a great French restaurant.
Hasn't that been a problem anyway that people have complained about to the point where Ruth Reichel did 2 reviews of a restaurant where they recognized her and where they didn't recognize her, that if the restaurant knows you, you're going to get a different meal. If you're a celebrity, you're going to get a different meal.
Well, the same thing happened to me at the old Le Cirque. That's the restaurant you're talking about, which was famous.
But it could happen at any restaurant. I've had friends complain about pretty much every restaurant in New York that the person sitting next to them, the famous person, was obviously getting a different meal than they got.
Well, I think
the same price.
You know, if you're Taylor Swift, the world is different for you. And there's just no getting around that. But there are some restaurants which are so built around 2-tier service. And not so many anymore, I think. That's a world that has, to some large degree, vanished.
You definitely helped Lutèce by giving it a 4-star review.
No, that was a mission. I really felt that this was the best restaurant in America, clearly the best French restaurant, and that for reasons they were unattractive reasons that kept them from getting recognized.
Did you have any fallout from some of the reviews?
Some, but not that one.
Did people recognize you? Because that's always been an issue with reviewers.
I was so unknown. It took, I mean, there may have been a time, I mean, places where I went later and interviewed them, of course they recognized me, but I wasn't reviewing them anymore.
Now, this is a time when there were other changes in the food scene. We suddenly an influx of great chefs from China who had not been able to come here before. So we were getting top-level Sichuan and Hunanese food.
Yes, because the immigration law changed. The Hart Celler Act of, I think it's 1964, made it suddenly possible for Chinese, for Asians to come to America. They had been deliberately excluded by the previous act, and suddenly people were coming who were not the descendants of railway workers from the 19th century, but were real restaurant professionals and represented all the regions of China.
Were people surprised when you gave 4 stars to a Chinese restaurant?
I think one in particular caused a lot of head scratching, and it wasn't particularly grand inside, and they really didn't know how to handle the celebrity. So, yeah, the old Hunan, which was a wonderful restaurant, at least in the beginning, caused people to wonder if I had taken leave of my senses.
But, well, there were two restaurants, Hunanese restaurants, that opened at that time. Both got 4 stars. The other one was Uncle Tao's.
That was somewhat later, yes.
And neither of them are around anymore. It's hard to sustain a restaurant on that level.
Uncle Tao left, I think. Yeah. And I don't really know what Michael Tong did with the Hunan.
Now, you also were causing a stir by doing other things. You performed taste tests on dog food. What prompted you to do that?
I think I was eager to leave that particular job, and I was a little restless, shall we say.
Was the Times happy with you?
The Times was, I think there was great tension between me and my ultimate boss. We just were like oil and water. And eventually, I had applied for work elsewhere, and he heard about it, and we decided I would leave.
And then you went to the Wall Street Journal?
Many years later, I was a freelance. I kept freelancing for the Times during the 70s, but in 1981, I took a job running a magazine for Dow Jones and eventually ended up at the Wall Street Journal running its arts page. And in the meantime, I had been doing a food column for Natural History Magazine at the Museum of Natural History.
And writing cookbooks.
Several.
So tell us about the writing you did at Natural History. You wrote a piece about cannibalism?
I did. I wrote a lot of more conventional pieces about American regional food that became a book called Fading Feast. But I started out thinking I should do anthropology for the Museum of Natural History and how food and culture or ethnography work together. And it was not actually such a reach to do cannibalism.
You didn't eat any human flesh.
No, I didn't, but I scoured the ethnographic literature to determine what were the most desirable cuts. And that turned out to be fingers.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, in the same sense that chicken wings are people like them. More, there's more, I don't know, the closer to the bone, the sweeter the meat.
I'm never going to Buffalo without my gloves on. What was, can you tell us about the first ever Oxford Symposium of Food and Cookery?
The first public one.
Yeah, that was 1981.
Was it 81? I guess so. There is debate about it. But 200 of us or 150 assembled at St. Anthony's College, and people from all walks of gastronomic life. There were food historians, restaurateurs, people who just like to eat well, food writers, food journalists, all got together, and there was a kind of anarchic discussion.
Now, one of the reasons that many chefs have given for New York's food scene being a lot better is now so much of it is locally produced. There was a time when the top French restaurants used to import everything from France or the Mediterranean. As a witness to what's happened in New York over the last 40 years or so, do you think it's mostly a positive change?
It's absolutely a positive change, but I don't think it's because of local food production, although that's a good thing. I think what's much more important is that there are many, many people, Americans, who have trained in sophisticated restaurants all over the world and come back here and invented their own kinds of restaurants. Thomas Keller at Per Se and the French Laundry would be an example of that. And they're importing food from all over the world.
And then some very talented French chefs like Jacques Pepin, Daniel Boulou, Eric Ripert, Jean-Georges Van Gerichten came here to stay for a little while and wound up staying forever.
They stayed, and they also reinvented themselves in our midst.
Raymond Sokolov's memoir, Steal the Menu, a memoir of 40 years in food, is published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you, Leonard.